A warning, this podcast uses the sound of gunshots, live reports, firsthand accounts, and other sounds related to active shootings. If you need crisis counseling related to shootings, the National Disaster Distress Hotline is open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. You can call 1-800-985-5990 or text 66746. If you know someone who may be a danger to the community or may be considering an act of violence yourself, please seek help. You can call your local authorities immediately. Many times you can be anonymous. Sandy Hook Promise also has a tip system called Say Something Tips. Just go to sandyhookpromise.org. In the long history of mass shootings in the United States, there's also a history of people stopping or preventing them. We can break them down into four categories. The first, armed law enforcement. In a perfect world, they would be the first ones on the scene to react and the first ones to end the threat. The second is plainclothed, off-duty, or retired military or law enforcement officers. These people understand weapons, how they work, how they're used, and their weaknesses. They also feel an obligation to protect the public, even though they aren't officially on duty. The third, the much-discussed good guy with a gun, a person who's able to assess what's happening and eliminate the threat on his own. The fourth is a good guy without a gun. I'm using the word guy loosely, but in most of the highly publicized situations, it is typically a male who tries to thwart a gunman's efforts. This could be a teacher, a coach, an employee, someone who emerges from potential victim to hero. On July 17th, 2022, 20-year-old Jonathan Saperman of Greenwood, Indiana, exited the bathroom of the Greenwood Park Mall just before closing. He walked into the food court, armed with 100 rounds of ammunition, two rifles, and a pistol. He fired off 24 rounds, killing 56-year-old Pedro Pineda and his wife, 37-year-old Rosa Marian Rivera de Pineda, and 30-year-old Victor Gomez. He also injured two others. But within 15 seconds of opening fire, the gunman was on the ground, dead, shot and killed by armed 22-year-old Elisha Dickin, a legally armed citizen with a pistol who was also at the mall. Dickin reportedly stood over the gunman's body, pistol still pointed, when police arrived. He was heralded a hero and never charged with murder.
I think if he had not been there, by the time the police got there, there had probably been more people killed.
Thankfully, he was there when he needed to be, so right. He saved other lives.
He was just reacting without really thinking too much about it. He just stepped in and did the right thing.
It's good that he took him out, but I think it's, you know, also not good that, you know, somebody has to feel like they carry a gun.
The National Rifle Association tweeted a response to the story saying, quote, "We will say it again, the only way to stop a bad guy with a gun is a good guy with the gun," end quote. On May 24th, 2018, police in Lake Hefner, Oklahoma, were called to a shooting at Louie's on the Lake, a popular bar and grill. Three people were shot inside of the restaurant, including two young girls. Another person was also hit while walking outside. The gunman was in the parking lot when 35-year-old Juan Carlos Nazario and 39-year-old Brian Whittle arrived. Someone pointed the gunman out to Nazario, who then grabbed his personal legal gun from his car and engaged the gunman outside of the restaurant.
Bullets hit a mom and a daughter and a friend, sending them all to the hospital and sent more than 100 people running for their lives.
In today's world, nothing really surprises me anymore. I'm very grateful that whoever took care of this last night did what they did. I think that's incredible.
These stories are rare, though. Data from the Advanced Law Enforcement Rapid Response Training Center at Texas State University found bystanders stop active attacks about 16% of the time. In 464 attacks, 434 shootings, civilians stopped attackers 73 times before police arrived. But only 24 of those were stopped by armed civilians. That's about 5% of the attacks stopped by the so-called good guy with a gun. On August 21st, 2015, three American men, including a member of the Oregon National Guard and an Air Force service member, were aboard a high-speed train in France with 554 people when a Moroccan man, armed with a Kalashnikov assault rifle, a pistol, and a box cutter, started firing at passengers. Hearing the shots, the three unarmed Americans quickly sprung into action, rushing the gunman and tackling him to the ground. One was stabbed, but the three Americans ended up beating the man until he was unconscious. A British passenger helped tie him up. The three were applauded by then-President Barack Obama.
Because of their courage, because of their quick thinking, because of their teamwork, it's fair to say that a lot of people were saved.
Given French naturalization at their request and awarded France his highest distinction from France's president. Clint Eastwood eventually went on to make a movie about them, where they portrayed themselves. On April 22, 2018, Travis Rankin fired a Bushmaster XM-15 through the glass of a Waffle House in Antioch, Tennessee. He then entered the restaurant and continued shooting. Four people were killed, two hurt. Patrons hid behind counters and under tables. James Shaw Jr., an electrical technician, dove into a restroom. At one point, Rankin paused to reload. Seeing an opportunity, Shaw lunged at him, and the two wrestled for the gun. Security video shows the two pressed against a glass wall until Shaw was able to rip the gun away, flinging it behind the restaurant counter. His hand was burned from touching the barrel. Rankin, weaponless at that point, ran out of the restaurant, sparking a day-long manhunt before he was eventually arrested in a wooded area. It's believed that without Shaw's actions, more people would have been killed. He was awarded a BET Humanitarian Award and later testified at Rankin's trial.
I remember stepping over Akilah. I remember Torin, walking past Torin and seeing his lock blown off his head. I remember it all.
In Noblesville, Indiana, in May of 2018, a 13-year-old middle school student left Jason Seaman's science classroom and returned with two handguns. He started shooting. Seaman, a teacher, father, and football coach, was hit, as was a girl in the classroom, before Seaman was able to tackle the student and wrestle the gun away. The girl was critically hurt. Seaman's injuries were not life-threatening. The teacher was honored by the school, the community, the state, and even given a cruise for his heroic actions.
First off, as a person who isn't looking for attention, nor entirely comfortable with the situation I'm currently in, I want to make it clear that my actions on that day, in my mind, were the only acceptable actions I could have done given the circumstances. I deeply care for my students and their well-being, so that is why I did what I did that day.
In May of 2019, at Park Rose High School in Oregon, a student was seen wandering the halls. That was a routine call for Keenan Lowe, the school's football coach and part-time security guard, but the encounter was anything but routine. Lowe found the boy in a classroom wearing a trench coat, beneath it a rifle. In his book, Hometown Victory, Lowe said the student then pulled out the rifle and kids began to scream. The student pointed it at his own stomach and pulled the trigger. It clicked, but nothing happened. Lowe, seeing his chance, rushed the suicidal child, pulling him out of the classroom and into the hallway. Surveillance video released months later showed a dramatic scene as Lowe, a former University of Oregon football player, rather than fighting the emotionally distressed child for the rifle, hugging him, slowly pulling the gun away and handing it to another staffer. The two continued to hug until police arrived.
In a fraction of a second, I analyzed everything really fast. I saw the look in his face, look in his eyes, looked at the gun. I realized it was a real gun, and then my instincts just took over.
Lowe said in his book, quote, I expected to see the devil in those eyes, but I didn't. I saw quite the opposite. His pain, his suffering, his struggles were all so evident. He didn't need to be tackled or beaten or even held to the ground in that moment. End quote. Lowe was already a hero in the eyes of the school after the incident, but after the video was released months later, he became a national hero.
Since I first tweeted out this video Friday evening, it has been viewed more than 5 million times around the world on my Twitter account alone. The vast majority of comments express how deeply people were moved.
These are just a few of the stories of the heroes. Two others were kind enough to share their personal experiences with us. This is Interrupting the Next Mass Shooting, Chapter 2, He's Shooting. minute of 2024 active shooter statistics from the FBI. In the 24 active shooter incidents recorded by the FBI in 2024, June had the most with 5. 7 of those 24 shootings came on Mondays. There was only one on a Sunday and one on a Tuesday. 9 of the 24 happened between 6 a.m. and 12 p.m., with only 3 happening between midnight and 6 a.m. 12 happened in open spaces, 4 in commerce and educational buildings, 3 in government buildings, and 1 in a house of worship. While 45 people were shot in open spaces in those 12 incidents, only 3 died. Meanwhile, 31 people were shot in educational spaces, 8 died. Commerce and education had the highest number of deaths with 8 apiece. 7 of the shootings took place in a single location, 5 in multiple locations. Officer Christopher Weaver, now Sergeant Christopher Weaver, was one of the first to respond to the call of shots fired inside of the Henry Pratt warehouse in Aurora, Illinois, on a frigid February day in 2019. He and his partner arrived within hours, not quite knowing that a gunman had already killed several co-workers and was about to begin an hour-long gun battle with police.
911. Shot fired at 641 Archer.
Where?
Aurora.
Where?
641 Archer.
Where? Inside or outside?
Inside.
Where inside?
Inside the warehouse. The employee was getting terminated.
I heard gunshots. I saw a man with a gun. And I ran the away.
Okay, the man with the gun, is he black, white, or Hispanic?
He is black.
Okay, what is he wearing?
His name is Gary Martin.
Gary Martin?
Yes.
Okay, is he an employee?
Yes.
It is not secure. This guy is not in custody. Nobody moves any further, okay?
Okay.
Do not give him a target. Nobody moves.
Shots fired. First floor where? North end.
Shots fired north end. Shots fired west side.
I got a shot. Gunshot wound.
Is he conscious breathing?
Conscious breathing. We're down in a bay.
10-4.
We don't see him. He's on the south side by the docks. The dock, dock 14, by 14, by 14.
Johnson, need your status.
It's the door that says Pratt. That's where he's shooting out of. It's the broken glass window. I'm out with he's been shot. Leg, constant breathing. We're taking around the north side of the building through both doors.
Well, hi. Okay. He's just in the knee right now. Conscious and breathing.
I'm hit. I'm still in the fight.
I couldn't copy anything you said.
106, I think I'm hit. I just 32, I'm here. Been hit in the leg, but he's already in a squad going to the hospital.
I know, I need to know about 106.
Okay, he's okay. I'm with him, same 22's with him. He has a struggle. We're in the fight still.
We do not have an eye sight on him. We do not have a sight on him.
We got visual. Suspect appears to be down. Suspect appears to be down.
Suspect is down. I have 4 bodies in room 102. 4 bodies, second floor, 102. They're all J8.
I went back and listened to some of the dispatch audio from that day. You got a call of shots fired at Henry Pratt, and you and John Cebulski arrived within 4 minutes and actually got inside of the building at that time, correct?
Correct. Yeah, myself, John Cebulski, Jim Zegar, and Dave Sheldon.
And at that point, what did you know about the shooter, the victims, the weapon? Did you have any concept of what was going on, or was this just kind of a routine entry at this point?
No, yeah, routine is lightly there, but no, the only thing we had where I was actually on a separate call, I was doing a report a few blocks away, and I heard that go out, and I added myself to it. Because that was in my district, and John Cebulski and I shared that district on the southwest side of Aurora. So he was my district partner that day. And you know, little side note there. I grew up about three houses down from Cebulski. He's senior to me, obviously, but him being like 53, I think, at the time, and I was 39. And so that was just kind of odd. But anyway, I was on a separate call, and I heard that call go out, and I added myself to it. And all I heard that I can remember is, hey, shots are being fired in a business, people are hit, and then it's you got to get there. That's basically it. And I knew kind of where the building was because I used to have my lunch in a parking lot across the street. And Archer Ave is not, it's not a big road. It's about one block long in an industrial park. So unless you really knew where Archer Ave was, you'd have to look it up. And I, for a couple weeks before that had happened, I would have my lunch. I'd pack my own lunch and I'd sit in a vacant lot across the street because it's kind of off the main road. So I could, you know, enjoy my lunch there. And I remember looking up and seeing Archer Ave, and it just popped into my head. I know exactly where that's at.
But you had never been in that building before.
I had never been in that building before. I had been outside when I was a child because I grew up about four blocks away from there and used to play sandlot baseball at Lincoln Park, which is on the west side of the building there. But I had never been inside before. But we got that call and just immediately drove straight there.
There was no time to assemble or coordinate or anything like that. There was... I think we've seen in some of these situations, you rush in as quickly as you can to try to, you know, figure out what's going on and end the threat. We've also seen situations where maybe the coordination took a little too long. What kind of was the situation when you four, I guess, pulled up at that time?
So as I'm pulling up, and you're right, like you had said about just getting right in there and stopping the threat, that's exactly what's going through your mind. Is get in the building and stop the threat. As we were pulling up, I remember hearing on the radio, at least I think I did. I haven't listened to the radio traffic in probably since it came out on Facebook that first few weeks afterwards. But I remember hearing something about door two and moving north. And I had, that's the way that the shooter was going. I had previously worked in a school as a resource officer, and I was one officer for about 4,000 people in the building, and all the doors on the building are numbered, which is a huge help if people give out that information, because then we know almost directly where to go. Whether it's the first floor, second floor, third floor, 20th floor, we can get in and get in quick. So anyway, I remember hearing that as we were pulling in. And as I was pulling in, I looked straight ahead and saw door two. And I'm thinking, moving north, I know which way north is. We're going to cut them off where the two buildings meet. And I jumped out of my squad, and I could not get the trunk open to get my shield out. And I looked, and Jim Zegar had already had his shield. And I'm like, all right, we got a shield. We got a few guys. We're going in. And nothing was said. You know, we didn't have time to stand there and coordinate who's going to be in front, who's going to be in back, who's going to cover the sides. It's just, you're the first four. Thankfully, we had four. And the first four of us were able to get in that center door where the two buildings met. I think it was maybe sheer luck that that door was unlocked. You know, we could have forcefully breached it if we had to with either a squad or a Halligan or something. But that door was unlocked, so we were able to get in.
And you got up to the second floor, is that correct?
Yeah, initially when we made entry, Jim Zegar, you know, was in front. I was right behind him. John Cebulski was right behind me, and Dave Sheldon was in the back. It was quiet. We didn't hear anything. For a second, I thought maybe we're in the wrong building, you know, because it's kind of an industrial building. And that building wasn't necessarily marked Henry Pratt Company. You know, I think it was marked like Shetland Business Park. And we made our way into that warehouse, and it was quiet. And that was kind of an eerie feeling until, you know, we started hearing gunshots right away.
Were those gunshots aimed at you guys at that point?
No, that was Marco Gomez, was another officer responding who was running through the parking lot towards our location, and he had been struck by the gunman. So we immediately turned around and went back the way we had come through the warehouse. And as we were running back, I heard somebody on the radio say parking lot. Instinctively, through my training, which, by the way, is second to none here. We do so much in-house training. We have 6 in-house trainings a year. I was fortunate enough to be on our SRT or SWAT team for a few years, and I got a ton of training through that. And just instinctively, without even having to think about it, I hear parking lot. I think I have to get up top. So that's why I went up to the second floor. Maybe I can get on top and stop him from an elevated position.
So you didn't really think then at that point. The training just kicked in.
Yeah, exactly right. And it's a lot of, and it's with the trainings that we do here at Aurora, there's not a lot of downtime. And if there is, you're usually talking to other officers, men and women. And it's, there's some joking going around too, but you can kind of see the way somebody else's gear is laid out. You can kind of, talk to them about things that they've been through, things that worked, things that didn't. And we do trainings on everything from de-escalation to defensive tactics and driving and all this sorts of stuff. And it was instinctual. It was parking lot, get in an elevated position, stop the threat, tend to the wounded. And that's all that's going through my mind. So when they... Sorry, that cart's going by here.
Yeah, no problem.
So when I heard that, I ran up the stairs, and Cebulski, I call Bull, ran right up behind me. And so we started to proceed down that second floor. We got to the first bank of windows to the exterior, and there was no visibility of the parking lot. The windows were not what I thought they would be. Not necessarily dirty, but like an off clear, right? Mm-hmm. And small, and there was no advantage there. And we could hear the shots being fired. So I thought they were coming from inside the building, the direction we were going. So we kept moving, pushing forward, which would be east through the building on the second floor. And as we were going, Bull had located several of the victims. I located another, and we kept pushing forward.
Were these victims who had been shot at this point?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. And, but we have to stop the threat, and so we keep moving forward. And we got to a stairwell, a doorway at the top of the stairs. And again, through the training things that we do here, you don't stand in a doorway, right? It's called a fatal funnel. So I pushed past that doorway and cut back. And at that point, the shots were really loud. So I knew this is where he's at. As I cut back, the door, just gun smoke right in front of my face from the shooter. He was shooting at Bull. And I returned fire several rounds and announced our position, yelled Aurora Police, and more shots continued. So I fired more shots. Then his shots stopped. So I didn't know, was he down? Because I hadn't seen him. All I knew was that he was shooting at us, and I never saw his face, nothing like that. And when the shooting stopped, Bull said, "I'm hit," and I didn't know where he went. I turned around; he was gone. He had crawled into an office space directly behind me, and so I went back in there with him, kind of assessed his situation, and he was okay. That dude is tough. He's very, very tough. He took a shot right through the kneecap and stayed in the fight.
I think I read you did an interview and you said that you were, when you started engaging, you were nervous that there were maybe Aurora police on the other side.
Yeah.
There was concern of possible friendly fire there.
Yeah. Yeah. Cause I never saw the shooter. As scary as that is. And, because when I cut back to that doorway, it was just, we were taking rounds. Mm-hmm. And so my immediate response is stop that threat. And that's why I yelled Aurora Police, because I didn't want it to be a blue on blue, as we call it. or a friendly fire thing. And when I yelled that and more shots came our direction, I knew it was him.
Do you, is that the only thing you shouted at him? Did he say anything? I know you didn't see him, but did he say anything? Did you hear him speak at all?
No. Okay. No, he didn't say a word. Not a word.
At this point, you have no idea who this person is, what they're working with, where, what their intention is, or anything like that.
Right. I think we started to get his name over the radio. And this is all happening super quick for me. So I'm not sure when his name came over the radio. And quite honestly, I don't remember his name. I don't think about him much, as I do about my fellow officers that were wounded that day, and especially the victims that lost their lives. I think about them all the time, and their families. So, but he never said a word, said anything to us.
What happens at that point? Cebulski's down. Do you need to extract him, or are you still, we got to find this shooter? No.
Yeah, we can't. We can't. At this point, he's injured in the knee. And so I made the decision because of the not knowing the layout of the building. Mm-hmm. And my partner's injured and immobilized. You know, he's taking one through the kneecap, so he can't get up. We don't know where the shooter has now gone in the building, or if he's going to return to these victims. We have a good position on the second floor to prevent him from getting on top of other officers. Does that make sense?
Okay.
So I made the decision, we're going to stay right there. And that's where we held up in there. I maintained, cover on the hallway that we hadn't cleared yet. The stairwell where the shooter went, the elevator directly in front of us, my partner, and the rooftop behind us through the windows to the roof, to in case he had roof access. You know, we don't know these things. And Bull, like I said, I mean, he's a really, really tough guy, and he is the epitome of a veteran officer, right? So he's hit. And he's still in the fight, and he's maintaining cover while being injured on the hallway that we had just cleared in case this guy doubles back and tries to sneak up on us from behind. So we're in it together. And at the same time, we're hearing now other officers being hit. So we know that he's continuing, you know, his barrage of gunfire on.
These were the officers outside that were trying to get into the parking lot. This is when he's downstairs. We've seen that video. Okay.
Yeah, correct. And that's when Jim Zegar, who I had originally gone in the building with, he was struck and was refusing to leave the scene because he is a hero. And Adam Miller, a young, newer officer at the time, was struck in the eye, and you want to talk about guts. He was struck in the eye, and on the radio says, 106, I'm hit. I'm still in the fight.
I heard that. I actually pulled that sound, yeah.
You know what? And it gives me chills just thinking about it today. To have, and then that, when he said that, and I've told him this too, so you know, this shouldn't be a surprise to him, but when he said that, and Bull and I were up on that second floor just kind of hunting, you know, that gave me my second wind, because, you know, when you're in a moment like that, and, you know, you don't really know where the threat's going to come from, and you're just kind of hyper-focused on, you know, your partner, the hallway, the stairwell, the elevator, the rooftop, and knowing that people can't get to you, you know what I'm saying? When he said that, that just really, you know, pulled me out of, you know, kind of more of a concern and more into, all right, we're in this, we're still in this fight. Everything's going to be okay. And Ray Rivera was also struck, you know, coming up with a shield, trying to, you know, get to us, get in the building, stop the shooter. And, so all these guys, I mean, nobody stepped back. Everybody kept pushing forward, and that's just insane to me. And it's incredible. And yeah,
how long were you in the building then? Because I know it took like an hour before the shooter was confirmed down.
Yeah, it's, I mean, it felt like a lifetime, right?
Right.
Because things that I'm hearing up there, you know, the sound is different. My ears are ringing. Listening to the radio, I'm watching Bull. He's watching me. You know, we're watching each other. And I think at one point I heard the Bearcat crash into the Bearcat's the armored car, right? Mm-hmm. I heard that crash into the building, but I didn't know that's what it was. I thought that was more shots being fired. I think I had maybe even called that out on the radio and they corrected me and said, no, we're driving the Bearcat into the building. So I want to say maybe about 40 minutes or so around there where we were just, you know, trying to held up and hold them down the second floor together. And yeah, and then the next thing I saw was a former commander. He's retired now, but Rick Robertson, he goes out and trains people now, and he's one of the best trainers around, especially for this type of scenario. But he came in and he said, "We're getting you out of here," you know, and it was just kind of like, "All right, here we go," you know, game time.
You didn't see any employees there. There were no employees by where you guys were hunkering down or hiding or anything like that.
There may have been. I didn't personally see any.
Okay.
Even like when we first came into the warehouse, when we initially got there, we didn't see anybody. You know, we could hear machines running, but there was nobody at them, you know. And then even when we cleared that second floor, Bull and I, and started moving down there, we didn't see any employees that were hiding or you know, coming out and grabbing us like, you know, thankfully you're here. I think everybody was kind of ducking for cover or had already left the building. And that kind of ties into that whole like run, hide, flight kind of things that we teach. Now, if you can get out, get out.
Yeah.
If you can't get out, hide. And if you can't hide, you got to fight.
It's interesting talking to people who have gone through it and have also been through it. And, you know, your body responds a certain way. Yes. You know, some people may be more willing to fight. Some people may be more willing to run. You know, you never know until you're in that moment. What I found interesting going back and listening to the dispatch audio is, I mean, at that point, you guys are in there. I'm hearing Naperville, Elgin, Kane, SWAT teams coming in. I mean, it was chaos. And, you know, speaking to your point about potential friendly fire, I mean, you've got everyone converging on this place. You need to identify where you're at so that you're not caught in something, obviously.
For sure, for sure. And I'll touch on that in a moment. I mean, we got, once we got Bull out, we ended up taking him out in the Bearcat because they had crashed it through that door. I think it was like door number 14 or whatever. Mm-hmm. And we pulled him up in the back of there, got him out to an ambulance, and then we turned that thing around and went right back into the building.
Okay.
At that point, now that we had cleared, you know, the second floor and all of that, we were able to set up like little task force teams, you know, and you will have somebody from, let's say, Elgin, somebody from Naperville, and myself as a three officer team. You know, and if one's got a shield, one's got a rifle, one's got a radio, you guys are a team. You know, and then that way you're not, you know, whoever's on the radio, because we're using Aurora's channel, who's ever on the radio can then, you know, kind of control that team movement so that we know where we're going, that we're not running into another team, you know, or suspecting them for somebody else. So that it worked out really well.
You guys fold in into each other pretty well then?
We do. And you know what? That's one of the benefits of doing so much training. Like we do here with Aurora, we do a lot of multi-jurisdictional training. You know, we did when I was on SRT, our SWAT team, our special response team. You work with other departments because while, you know, the radio lingo might be different, where we use, you know, common English, you know, speech here on our radios, another jurisdiction might use 10 codes, you know, and so it's good to have somebody from the home jurisdiction with the radio on your team so that you know, maybe where officers are moving so that you don't want to go that way, you know. Yeah. As far as like tactics go, we all go to like similar academy training and have similar, you know, like weapons and movement training where, you know, if somebody has a shield, all right, I know I'm going to get behind that and not run up next to him or try to run up ahead of him. You know what I mean? Because it's there for a reason.
Regardless if that person's from Elgin or Naperville or wherever.
Yeah. So we do these multi-jurisdictional trainings, and it's part of our foundation, at least here in Aurora, where we take it seriously and we train because the preparation and the planning is all done at training, right? You don't have time to do that when you're pulling up on scene. Mm-hmm. Most times, especially not in this type of scenario. It's go. You know, it's go time from the time you pull up. At least for us, it may be because we have multiple jurisdictions that work in the city of Aurora, within the city limits. We have Aurora, Kane County, DuPage County, Kendall County, Will County, Park District Police. So if, you know, myself, a Park District officer, a Kendall County Sheriff's Deputy, and a Kane County Sheriff's Deputy pull up, we're the first four. We're going.
Yeah.
And we're not sitting around waiting. We need to stop the threat because the longer time we take, you know, that's more damage he can cause.
You laid this out pretty well. I'm interested. This is, we'll say, an hour long or so based on the information I have from the time of the call to the time that, you know, the threat was gone. It might have been a little bit longer. You laid it out well, what you remember, but I mean, are there certain parts that you just, your memory's trying to fill, you don't really remember? Are there things that you do remember vividly? Smells, sounds, like, this is the moment, this is what I saw?
Vividly, I remember the gunpowder from the end of his, from the business end of his pistol in front of my face. I remember the door frame, pieces of the door frame coming off. That's how close I was. I remember, you know, the things that really, really stick out to me are Adam Miller's voice on the radio, my first FTO's voice on the radio, my very first training officer, Rick Drozdowski, hearing him in route. You know, there are some officers that when you hear that they're on their way to help you on a call, it literally takes a weight off because you know that they're the best. They're the best of the best, the cream of the crop, and they're coming to help you. And it relieves some of that pressure. You know what I mean? And when I heard Rick Drozdowski was coming, it was like, all right, I'm going to be good. He was my very first training officer. Miss him around here. He was a great guy. If he ever hears this, still talk to him once in a while, but he was there that day too. And when I heard he was coming, that just, it kind of put me at ease, like, all right, we're going to be good. And, we were on SRT together as well. And, you know, had some great conversations when he was my training officer. So, there's things like that, you know, as far as like, there's nothing I don't remember because, part of this, you know, these types of scenarios, these types of incidents, is that you replay them over and over and over again. Things that you could have done better, mm-hmm. Wish they'd gone differently. I mean, honestly, of course I wish this had never happened at all. Cause it's a huge tragedy. And there are things that, I will always replay over and over my head. You know, could I have turned left here? Could I have turned right here? What if I hadn't gone upstairs and just gone straight, you know, or straight through the warehouse? I could have cut them off over here. But this is all things that I learned after the fact, after seeing photos, after even getting Bull out and going back in and teaming up with guys from different jurisdictions and working our way towards the shooter again, that I started to see more of the layout of the building. And I'm like, oh, you know, crud, I could have gone, you know, straight here and right here. But you don't know that, you know, until everything is all said and done.
Is that something that were there lessons learned that you can pass along to other people then? Because, I mean, yeah, you were in a very unique situation. You know, there are not a lot of people who have been in that kind of situation.
No, for sure. I mean, I, you know, to the civilians out there, I would say, abide, you know, pay attention. Like if your business or if your school or you know, whatever, whoever's offering this training, if you get into some sort of active shooter training and it's through a school or a business or what have you, because I know both of them run it, pay attention. And if you can run, run. If you can hide, hide. And if you get put in a position to fight, where you have to fight, then fight for your life, because it certainly depends on it.
Would more employees being in there in that area have complicated things quite a bit? I mean, I know that people were getting pulled out, but obviously, you know. Sure.
What I would say is, I guess for an officer, you know, when you're going into a situation like this, as we're trained to do, we're going to bypass them anyway and go straight to the threat. And I keep talking about training because that is the main. And there's two reasons why I'm here talking to you today. And number one is God, looking out for me and putting me in that position. And then number two is the training. And we had just trained active shooting scenarios and response maybe 2 weeks prior to this, about six blocks away at a vacant school building. And it was everything from pulling up in a squad car to grabbing the gear that you need to making the entry with whoever. And they would rotate people out, so you're not getting the same group going in every time. And then another group is coming in, so now you have to coordinate with that group on where you last saw the shooter. All right, well, we're going to go down this way and up this way if you go up this way and over that way. So that's just a huge thing for us. So if there were more people in there that were visible to us as we're moving forward, because that's our job, I tell them to get out, because anywhere behind us has already been safe. You know, sure. It's already been cleared out. So just run past us and get out, because we're pushing towards the threat. My advice to officers who haven't been through something like this, or if they're new or coming on the job, would be when your department offers this training, to take it seriously. And it's not just, you know, the reps, it's physical training. You know, I'm that goofy guy at the gym that walks backwards on the treadmill, you know, like carrying weight. Because these, in my mind, these shields are heavy. You know, they're not light. And we have different ones we have bigger ones that are even heavier. But my point being is, like, I'm that goofy guy at the gym that'll walk backwards on a treadmill carrying weight, because I may be in the back with a shield. And when you walk backwards, it's different than walking forwards and use different muscles. So that to me is important. You know, and it's also mental preparation. It's when you're in church or in a business or, you know, just even out with your family, that, you know, you're just assessing things. And that's something that police officers, I think, instinctually do anyway. And when we go to a restaurant, there are certain seats that we like to sit at for a good reason. And we're constantly assessing people and situations and rooms. So I would tell those officers, like, when you get this training, take it seriously. You know, if you're going to your kid's school for parent teacher night, you know, pay attention to what door you walked in. You know, what number was on that door? What side of the building is it on? You know, and I'm not saying that you have to be, you know, super tactical mom or dad, you know, going to this parent teacher conference, but, you know, start paying attention to those little things, you know, and they'll add up over time, and they'll pay off, because that was something that I definitely learned being a school resource officer at a high school with about 4,000 people, is that those mental reps of, hey, I'm the only cop in here. So if something goes bad, it's on me to take care of it, to handle it. And, you know, and I would also, like, talk to other staff members. Several of them had prior military experience, and we'd have these conversations like, hey, if something goes down, can I count on you to, like, back me up on this? Yeah, of course. Great. You know, and I kind of, like, enlisted my own little team of, you know, we're at least going to have to handle something before my partners can get here. You know, more police can get here with more equipment or what have you. So you got to have those conversations.
What's life been like since then?
Well, it's been different. Like, it was shortly after that. I got promoted in 2020. This is 2019, obviously. But, you know, then, like, COVID happened. Things got weird. our whole schedules changed. You know, we'd be on for 12 hours and for a few days and then off for 10 days in case you got COVID and all that stuff. So, but then I got promoted during COVID and I went to midnight shift. So that was just a little weird. I will say too, there's something I want to talk about if you don't mind. I don't know how long we have.
I've got 6 minutes left on this, but if you think it's going to go longer, we can just re-upload in the same link and go a little longer if you want.
All right. Well, let me just touch on this too, because I'll say this to newer officers as well. You know, yes, how life has been since then. Obviously, like I felt personally prepared for something like this because of the training that I had, not only at the department, but things I did on my own. What I wasn't prepared for was how it would affect me mentally afterwards. And APD does a great job with mental health awareness for their officers. A lot of us go through a place called First Responder Wellness. It's run by Dr. Carrie Steiner. She is amazing. Her staff is amazing. Now, I had never been to them beforehand. I've been a police officer for 23 years, 22 with Aurora. And because I was involved in the shooting, mandatory that you have to go. And I hit it off with Dr. Steiner. She was amazing. And I continued to go. And I learned so much more about myself. Not just this incident, but things, you know, like in my past and my perceived future, things that I wanted to accomplish. And a lot of that came about because of this incident. And it was a huge help. It was a huge help. So I would encourage younger officers, like if you're just starting out, because when I first started, we didn't talk about mental health.
Sure.
You know, and it's not that it was a weakness or anything like that. We didn't talk about it. And so now we talk about it all the time, especially here at this department, because we want people to be healthy, not only physically, but mentally. You know, and we deal with a lot of trauma, not just big incidents like this, but, you know, your day-to-day stuff, especially seeing things that happen to children or, you know, bad crashes or house fires where somebody may perish. It's just, it takes its toll and it weighs a lot on your shoulders. And so if you can link up with First Responder Wellness or a place like that early on in your career, it's going to pay off dividends, huge dividends as you get older, because this is a marathon, not a sprint. I will never forget Trevor Wehner, Vicente Juarez, Clayton Parks, Josh Pinkard, and Russ Beyer. Yeah. I will never forget them.
Army veteran Richard Fierro, who had served 15 years in the military, including multiple tours of duty in Iraq and Afghanistan, had settled into life in Colorado Springs with his wife and adult daughter running a brewery. On November 19th, 2022, he, his family, and some friends decided to see a drag show featuring a family friend at Club Q. It was Fierro's first ever drag show, and one he would never forget. Are you a Colorado native?
No, I'm originally from San Diego, California, so is my wife. We grew up, born and raised there, never really left, and then I ended up in the Army. Long story, but we had our first kid at 15 or 16, and I was looking around for something to do, and the recruiter was like, "Do you want to join the Army?" I said no, but he handed me an application just based on what I told him I got on the SATs, and I tried to get into West Point, but then I didn't know you couldn't have a dependent, so I was at San Diego State doing my physical. They told me, "Hey, you got to sign all your rights over to your girlfriend." And I said, "Well, she's not my wife yet. So how about no?" I'm an 18 year old kid making a life decision. I go, I can't do that. I don't even know what I'm going to do for the next 4 years. I'll be up there with you guys. And they said, "Well, we got a scholarship here at San Diego State. You can stay with your kid." So I did that. And then as soon as I graduated on the 26th of May, on the 10th of June, I was on a plane to Fort Lewis, Washington.
So you joined the Army then?
Yeah, so as an Army officer, field artillery officer, joined in, I got commissioned in 10 June 1999, went up to Fort Lewis. I was a lieutenant there, I did all my platoon time with 520th Infantry and 137 FA. And in that time, 9/11 happened. And so as a family, our whole world changed. We'd expected to do 4 years and be out, never expected to go to war, none of that. So I always go back to when I took my kids, I took both of my kids to see the 9/11 memorial a few times. And then also, and we've seen the pit before it was even a memorial. And then I took them over to D.C. to see the chairs there. And I was stationed in Oklahoma first. So we actually went to the night Oklahoma City bombing memorial there. And so I told my kids, like, this is what changed your lives. Like, this is these events, these memorials, these people that lost their lives are the reason your life has changed. And it changed forever. Right. And so those are those moments in life where you never really expect, and it shifts you completely. And I think that's kind of what this mass shooting was for us again. In 9/11, so I've got a weird tattoo, but it's a tattoo of 11, 19, and that 9 from the 19 with 11. Because for me, it was both in reverse. I was downrange due to 9/11, went 4 times to Afghanistan, or 1 time in Afghanistan, 4 years or 3 years in Iraq. And then I got this shooting happened, and it changed my life forever with my family. You go downrange and you expect to be with your battle buddies. You go to bed with them. You're immersed in it 24/7. You're saving each other's lives and doing things that just, you know, you never thought you would do, but that is expected in that place, right? You're out looking for an enemy. The enemy's looking for you. And so that challenge is there. It's been that year. And everybody around you is stuffing down those feelings and everything around you, you know, so we can get through it. We get through it. We come back home and then we all split off into our families. Some of them can handle it well. Some can't. I've always started looking after I got done with the military for mental health because I know I've changed and each deployment changes you. Every time you get shot at, it changes how you perceive life. It changes how you feel, right? And anger tends to be the thing that comes out most. And so for me, that was the biggest thing coming out of the military was learning that I was able to kind of work and do my job under stress and stress of combat, stress of whatever. None of it really affected my decision making or how I was going to lead my team. So for me, it was one of those things that tested by fire, if you will. And I always say that because I've had kids that were studs, they were supposed to be the best soldiers you could ever get. They got the best PT scores, did everything right. But as soon as they hear that first crack, that first ping off of the vehicle, they change, you know, and it's because it suddenly becomes real. It's a game as you train. It's a game as you work towards getting into combat, right? But that game becomes very real as soon as you hear the first round, and that tests you as to if you're able to handle that as a human. I think it's a physical reaction, and I can go through some of that with that mass shooting. It's very very visible there, but in combat, everybody tries to hide that stuff, right? So my if your gut reaction is to hide, you try not to do that, but some folks can't, and their body will just do that, right? Some guys, they'll cower under a vehicle or lock a door and not get out. Preservation of life becomes something that your human body, I think, responds to in different ways, and you won't know that until you're actually in that event.
Did they prepare you for that when you went Absolutely. Off to these combat zones?
Absolutely.
And best they can, too. Right?
Yeah. And that was my job, too, as an officer. I trained my troops. I led teams, I led staff elements, I led my company, I led battalions, brigade, you know, parts of the brigade. We owned battle space in Afghanistan, so I owned all of the province of Farah as a battalion element, and that's what we maneuvered in, and we tried to get rid of all the folks that were doing bad things there, right? And Afghanistan was a different fight than Iraq. I think Iraq was more of a kind of a business. It was very what we trained for, and Afghanistan is very hand-to-hand. And you start to realize, like, these people have been fighting for their whole lives and generations, right? And so they were just proud to work with us. I had my counterpart in the Afghan police department was like, hey, man, I want to show you where we blew up the Russian BMPs. You know, like, they were in fights to preserve their own lives. And you see that, and it changes kind of how your perspective is on all these different cultures and different places of the world where they're fighting just for survival, right? And it's not like they're fighting for the cities and mountains and all the beautiful things we have here. They're fighting for the meagerest things you can think of, family and maybe an ability to have a home, right? And it's made of mud and some some poppy sticks with water to cool you off, right? That's it. And so when you put those perspectives together, it changes how you perceive things in this world. I just lost my buddy, one of my platoon sergeants, killed himself this past week. And you think through your own, you know, that whole version of the story where you were out. And I'm like, was it that bad? You know, like, was it that bad that it changed him? But his body and his physical and emotional response led him somewhere dark, right? I think I go to dark places all the time, but I try to, you know, ground myself and do things to get myself out of those hard feelings. But I think that's what changes folks, and people see the, you know, combat deployed soldiers, they come back different. And it's not one of those things that you can see immediately. I think it's over time. It's 5-10 years later down the road, how your body and your mind are different than other folks. And it's just how your body responds to it, I think. That's just my opinion. I don't have no science or any of that stuff. Well, it's just from what I've kind of felt.
And obviously you found yourself in a position later after service that you know, you were actually able to use that training for. I want to get into that a little bit. Can you first kind of explain the scene at Club Q when you were there, kind of just initially why you were there and where you were at? And
yeah, absolutely. So honestly, me and my best friends, Chip and Joanne, my wife and I's best friends in the Springs, we all had kind of gone through these rounds of COVID at the time. So we were all hadn't seen each other for about a month, month and a half. Right. And so we wanted to get out, and Cassie, my daughter, at the time, 22, and she was dating for 6 years, Raymond Green, throughout high school. Her best friend, Wyatt, who goes by Potted Plant. Wyatt was doing a drag show that Saturday, and it was his birthday. Right. And so Cassie said, "Hey, Dad, you guys want to go to the drag show?" And I said, "Well, I don't have a problem with it. I've never had any problem with anybody." I go, "He's your best friend. We've seen him grow up. They met in the second grade. It was the first friend she made coming up back from Germany with me." And so from 2007 on, they've been best friends. She went to junior prom with Wyatt. She went to senior prom with Raymond, her boyfriend. And so that's that, you know, that's that importance of him in our lives. And we've always accepted him for who he is. And so he was there, and we went to dinner as a group, all six of us, myself, Chip and Joanne, Cassie, my wife, Jessica, and then Raymond. So the six of us were there. And a funny story, and I tell this sometimes, but I'm going to probably be long-winded with this thing, but I always remember Raymond because he'd always stay at the house, right? And he was always around. We took him on vacations. We took him to Hawaii with us. We took him everywhere. And so he was part of the family. And this kid, every time I came back from some kind of training that I was doing or whatever, because they still work for the DOD. And I'd come back and the snow would be on the driveway and I could see his footprints going through the snow. And so we came a running joke for us. "Hey, dude, you need to shovel the snow." Well, this Friday, when I got back from Oklahoma, I told him the same thing Saturday when we sat down for dinner. I said, "Raymond, I got a problem with you, man." He goes, I go, "You didn't shovel the snow." And he says, "Sir, I wasn't even at your house this week." And I go, "So I don't care anymore. You're going to go to the house and shovel snow." So this snow thing became our thing. He was always very close to my wife. Raymond's a great kid. He was just like me. He's just a football player trying to find his way. Not sure what he wanted to do with his life, but he knew he loved my daughter and my daughter loved him. Right. And so Cassie was on a break from college, or not college, but a certificate program for brewing at San Diego State, and my alumni, and she was going back in November to finish her semester there, and Raymond was going to go with her. And so they were, you know, going into that next step here shortly, and that didn't happen because of this thing here on the 19th of November. So we all went out, had our dinner, and we decided, and we convinced each other all to, let's go to this drag show, let's see what it's all about. So we all head down to Club Q separately. So all the couples went in their own vehicles and got down there. So me and Jess were the first ones there. When we walked in, and this is my first time in this club. My wife had been there before to see Wyatt perform. My first time in the club, I looked at it. There's this bar area that's kind of split between the performance area / dance floor, DJ, and some pool tables. And I told Jess, I go, "Well, I want to sit here against this wall because it, you know, the entrance is there. I can see everything. We're good." And she said, "No, we're going to sit on the dance floor and watch the performance. I want to be there, be able to give Wyatt some money and do those things that you do in a show." I'd never done it, so it was new to me. So we sat right on the corner of the dance floor, and we had five chairs, and there were six of us. So Chip and Joanne and Raymond and Cassie would rotate who got chairs, and everybody was kind of doing things. And so everybody got there, We had a great time. There's a video of all of us cheersing. Raymond had bought us all little jello shots because he felt bad about, because I had joked to him at dinner. I said, man, you're ordering all the best food and you're ordering drinks and you're not going to pay, man. And I guess he goes, Jed, shut up. You're going to, you know, like, you're embarrassing him. But it turned out that that night, you know, it was his last night and he had his best meal. He was hanging out with some of his best friends and, you know, great drinks and great fun, you know? And I always go back to, I tell my daughter, people pay millions of dollars to have that last moment with someone to be glorious and fun and happy. And not a tragedy that drags on for years, right? Or for months or even, you know, a few days. So for her, we take solace in that Raymond was as happy as he has been with us that night. And so that was really cool. So his joke, and he brought the jello shots and we all took our little shot. And then the girls started dancing and Raymond said, hey, I'm going to go. He actually asked Chip, because they played Nintendo, or I call it Nintendo, but whatever, the video games, they play that stuff together. And he asked Chip, hey, you want a beer? So he was going to go buy him a beer. And I told Raymond, don't buy any beer for yourself. I go, you're driving my daughter. And he goes, no, I got it. I'm drinking water. The bartenders all told me after, they remembered Ray because of that. He was the only one ordering water. Everybody else was drinking because it was like all you can drink that night. And so he went to go get Chip a beer. The girls were dancing right in front of us and they were having a great time, all three of them. And me and Chip were sitting at the table. And the shooter came in, you know.
Let me stop you before you get into that. Like, when did you notice something was wrong? Because I think one of the things that I'm realizing when talking to people in these situations is kind of the, you know, your initial response, your initial understanding of something is not right here. So kind of walk me through that.
Yeah. And so that's what it was. So the music's loud, it's dark, the lights are going, everybody's having a good time. So a loud noise isn't necessarily something that triggers you, but that was a distinct noise I know. Right. And so I knew it was gunfire. And then I immediately smelled the cordite or the gunpowder. You can smell it immediately.
That's what you noticed first, was the sound and then the smell.
Right. And so as the sound goes and the smell hits me, I'm still looking at the dance floor, my wife and daughter, and I can see the fear in their eyes, but they were still confused. It's like, is this the song? Is this, like, the confusion was there. And I went, are you fucking kidding me? And I turned and I didn't realize I said it. Chip told me that I said that. And I looked over my shoulder and I could see the shooter shooting into the bar area. And I went, shit. And so we all took to the ground. I think the girls went to the ground. I don't know, because they were out on the dance floor. I know for Chip, and Chip told me that he flipped the table and I ended up on the other side of the table to, when, you know, exposed to the gunman, but he flipped the table to try and help. Right. So he flipped the table, and he went down, and Joanne. So he had gotten shot twice in his knees, one knee, same bullet, but both knees got shot. And then Joanne had got shot five times and fell towards Chip. So she ended up landing towards Chip and they were next to each other. I didn't know any of this. I went around and I checked on Chip and I went to stand up and the shooter had shot across us, and it's pretty wild. So, and all this stuff is going to come out next month, and they're going to finally release all the freedom of information stuff. But the shooter had fired and shot everybody to our left. When, if you would have drawn a line to me and Cassie on the dance floor and my wife, he shot everybody, to include Joanne, who was next to her. Everybody got shot to our left. He must have turned or stopped firing to turn that corner, and that's where we didn't get shot. And everyone else to our right got shot. And my wife and daughter, Cassie, took to the floor, busted, shattered her knee, didn't know it because of the adrenaline, and she was, you know. So she crawled all the way to the back closet because she couldn't stand up, but she knew she had to get out of there. My wife ran towards the patio, which is where the gunman was going towards. She ended up in the back corner with one of the bartenders and the shot girl. And she was covering them. And they told me that they seen that barrel come through the window or the patio door, and they thought they were dead. Okay. The caveat to all this is that patio is not like every patio in every bar you've been to. El Paso County, back 20 years ago when Club Q was started, required them to have a 7-foot wall or 7-foot fence because they said they would pass beers. Well, they're tucked away behind the main area. They're hidden. And so I, you know, the Matthew told me that the reason for the 7-foot wall, I own a brewery. I have a fence about 3 foot tall that anybody can jump over, anybody can do anything on. But they had a 7-foot fence, really kind of well built with roll ups and all this other stuff. And these kids were trapped. And so you can see at the aftermath, there was kids that were digging through the walls trying to get out. because there was no way they were going to jump a 7-foot fence. So those roll-ups went down, and my wife was in there with those two. I took to the ground. I get up, I slip on what was probably blood or beer. I have no idea, because Chip and Joanne were bleeding all over the place by that time. I get up, I slip on the blood, and I fall back to the benches that I thought I was going to sit at in the beginning. And so it's a long bench against the wall. I hit my back, and that first thing I go is, oh, shit, I may not be able to get up. And because I got a bad back, I'm a big kid, and I was like, oh, shit, I just hurt myself. But as soon as I open my eyes looking that way, I can see the shooter in the patio window. And so I stood up and I ran over. I did not know at that time he was engaged. Thomas James. Sorry. So Thomas had jumped over when this kid dropped his 60 round. So he had a 60 round drum. And in 45 seconds from the front door to the back door, he had killed 5 and wounded 19. You do the math. That was a full 60 round. And Joanne had 5 bullets in her. The girl in the front door had 14 bullets in her. This guy mowed us all down. The intent was to kill us all. So his 60-round mag, he drops it in the actual patio window after he killed or almost killed, and he later died. Not Daniel, but the other kid, the other bartender. Thomas James grabbed his muzzle. He's got burns on his hand. He grabbed the rifle muzzle and burned his hand and then started fighting with the guy as he was trying to change his magazine. He came in with a rack of full, so he had another 440 rounds or something on his chest and a 9mm in his front pocket with 3 magazines for that extended clips. So this guy was going to kill us all. And then he had some kind of fragmentary something. They said it was like a makeshift grenade that he tried to build at home with pennies and shit. And it was a stun grenade, but it had pennies all melted into it or whatever. And so that was on his chest too. And he had his vest. So I saw him and I ran over towards him. Didn't know he was already fighting with Thomas. And Thomas got shot. So this kid pulled a 9mm, shot Thomas in the sternum. Also, I didn't know that either, right? So as I'm running across, you can hear in the video the round that goes off to shoot Thomas. So when I get there, Thomas is starting to fall to the floor, and he's taking the rifle with him and the guy. So we all end up on the floor. The rifle's still in front of the shooter. Thomas is in front of him with his feet towards his head, the shooter's head, and his head going away from him. So I didn't know who was shot. I didn't know who it was. I had no clue. I knew that the guy with the armor on was the shooter. Apparently, when we went to the ground, he took a knee and he tried to shoot me with the 9mm. But because it didn't have any rounds in it and it had dropped the magazine before he had chambered a second round, it didn't go off. I grabbed the gun out of his hand. I immediately tried to shoot him with it just to... because I was like, they got to do something. And then I pushed him to the floor and started beating him with his pistol.
Did you see his face at all? Did you speak?
Never did.
Did he speak? What was his demeanor? No.
I don't know. I never heard any of that. Because, again, you got to understand, it's a disco club. So it's dark. The music's still going. Lights are still moving. People are running around. They're screaming because they're shot. They're either seeing people dead. It's chaos, right? So as soon as I got his pistol from him, I get down on top of him. And so I didn't see his face. I pushed him right down into the floor, started shoving his flak vest into the back of his neck, because I know that's another thing that hurts you. All I was doing was hitting his skin. Wherever I could see a body part, I was hitting him. So I ended up on his head. I always go back to like Silence of the Lambs, where he was just swinging away. That's what I'm doing with his pistol into his head, the back of his head. And I'm yelling at Thomas James. I said, get the AR. So Thomas tries to kick it away. It was still within arm's reach because the strap was on him. So it was still like there. I mean, he was reaching for it. And I'm pulling his arms away. I'm beating him. And then he's reaching for magazines. So I'm throwing magazines out of the way. And I'm submitting his pistol. And I'm trying to put I'm honest to God, I'm telling myself I'm going to kill you. Or I'm telling him, I'm going to kill you. So I'm motivating myself. I'm telling Thomas to keep kicking. I'm yelling at everyone to call 911. I got the shooter, call 911. I'm trying to manage the situation, get somebody in here to help us out, right? That's what I was taught to do in the Army under the most stress, the most, it's kind of action on objective. You get your wounded, you get people ready, but you got to suppress the enemy. That's fine. I'm yelling at Thomas, and this is about 6 minutes of the fight. So I'm yelling at Thomas, kicking him in the head. I've got people coming by. I'm like, hey, help me kick this guy in the head. Nobody wants to do it because they're scared already. They don't know what's going on. And I've got this pistol that I'm jamming in this guy's head, hammering into his head. and he stops moving about a minute before the cops showed up. I thought I killed him, and I just kept going because I at the end of the day, if I killed him, I killed him. I didn't really care at that point, but I needed him not to ever get back up. So that's what I just kept doing. When the cops showed up, they turned the corner. I see their little light on their rifles. And I'm like, this is the shooter. And I kept, you know, they told me to put my hands up. So I throw the weapon. I put my hands up. I get off the guy. I tell him that's the shooter. And I'm wasted. I'm a fat kid, man. As soon as I got in the army, I let it all go. Right. And I lean over the railing and you can see in the video, I'm like, I'm just spent. But Thomas had jumped up and ran out because he was like shot and was trying to get out of there. So I didn't know who Thomas was until after all this happened. And that was the crazy part. So, I get up and I think about, oh shit, where's my family? Because my entire family was there. Everybody I love in the Springs was in that room. So I go back to where we were sitting, and there's Joanne with five holes in her. Chip is leaned over her holding, her lung, she had one in her lung, two in her arms, all on one side, and two in her leg. And when I saw her, I was like, dude, you're going to lose your arm. That's gone. Where else? Let's work on the leg. Let's work on the lung. And so Chip goes, I can't hold it no more. And then I realized he was shot. So he falls over. The whole time he was helping her, he's on his knees. And that's where I'm like, everybody in that room was a hero, not me. You know, the kid that called 911, the kid that took my daughter into that closet, and they were praying together. And Cassie's telling them, hey, I my dad can't handle this because she can hear me yelling at this guy and yelling at people to do shit. And it was crazy. And my wife's in the patio thinking that they were going to die. And for 6 minutes, nobody knew what was going on because I'm over there fighting with this guy. And there's no more loud pops. There's no more gunfire. But nobody knows I'm fighting with the guy. Everybody sees the dark. They hear the music and they're running around trying to, you know, get out. And so I always go back to whether they were holding their own wound or their friend's wound. That's heroic stuff, man. Nobody expects to ever do that. I told Chip, you held your wife together for 6 minutes until I got there. And that's, you saved her life. You know, you saved your own wife's life. That's like, there's nothing else you can do. I don't see it as I saved anybody's life. I see it as I stopped the person that was hurting everybody in there. And everybody in there that moment was our family, you know? And so it's not my thing. It's more everybody else's thing. Everybody did something, you know? And there was a kid that ran to a 7-Eleven, had a bullet wound in his back, and finally passed out. But he was running, you know, he was trying to get out of there, get help. And this is at, you know, like close to midnight. So it's one of those things that you just, you know, you look at the whole picture and it's crazy. So I went over to where I was seated and Chip and Joanne were there. I start helping Joanne and I'm yelling at cops, get your ass in here, get on a fucking body. I'm telling the cops, shoot the fucking shooter. I am amped. Everything's going. I'm trying to get people on bodies from where I'm standing with Joanne. I apparently told my wife to stay the fuck back, because she was trying to come over because she saw me. I didn't know. I didn't recognize her. And I told her to stay the fuck back. You can see this. I told him to put the tourniquet on Chip's legs and he folded because it was the most pain he'd ever felt in his life. And I saw that. And as soon as they put him on, he thought, oh shit, I'm going to die. She's going to die. And then he reached for her hand and then it was the wounded arm. She couldn't feel anything. She was just a hit, really. And I put her hand in his hand. I said, Joanne, you're holding Chip's hand, doing, you know, you guys are together. And because I'd seen her in and out of life, you know, you're seeing her eyes. I'm telling her to stay with me. But you can tell she had gone in and out multiple times. She barely survived, but she made it. To us, she's a fighter. She stayed alive for her children. She's got two little ones. She stayed alive for Chip and her family and everything. And so those moments are things that, you know, you in all this chaos, it's about family again. It's about making sure they were connected before they get separated and put into different ambulances or whatever happens. And then at that point, for some, I don't know why, but they arrested me at that point. Apparently the shooter was saying I was the shooter. So they took me out and dragged me into the vehicle. And I was in there for about half an hour, an hour. And I still didn't know where my wife and daughter was. And I had seen them, but I didn't remember it. I didn't notice it. Walked over and I realized my daughter's knee was like twice, it was a basketball. And I was like, are you hurt? And she's like, yeah, I think I can't walk. So we sit her down in the police vehicle and they were going to take her in an ambulance. I said, no, man, I'm not paying $4,000 for a ride to the thing with a knee. I go, you're taking her in this police car. You're getting me in it because, you know, they've already put me in. I said, you're taking her. If you want to take me back to questioning, you're taking her first. So we're all sitting in the back of a police vehicle going to the hospital. They drop off my wife and daughter and take me to do the questioning and all the, you know, all the evidence stuff. And because they didn't know, you know, I guess whatever. Didn't make sense to why the hell I would be a shooter, but that's you know, the here or there. So, but they got me back to my wife and daughter.
You described the scene really well, but you also said that there were things that you don't remember saying, you don't remember doing. I mean, is it just Absolutely. Kind of when you think back to that? I mean, is it just kind of flashpoints? There are just certain things that are sticking with you, and other things you think your brain is kind of filling in some of the blanks, or do you really remember that whole 6 minutes of
it does out? And I will tell you, I think what people don't recognize is everybody sees it on the news, the shooter going into the room. Nobody sees the other side of that. When you're on the other side of that, you know what's going on. You know the extreme panic, the extreme, like this is happening right now. Wherever you're at, it's happening. And you've got to either be able to deal with it or not. My human body allowed me to do things that I needed to do, right? But what it didn't do is give me those moments of, I see my wife and daughter, remember that part. It's unnecessary at the moment. It's about keeping your head alive. It's about getting people out. It's about getting at least some bodies. So my wife and daughter at that time, for my body, I think, it was saying, no, you don't need to deal with that. They're okay. Register. Get on. Move on to the next thing. And so my wife, well, she told us that for a long time, she didn't remember any of it. She didn't remember walking. She walked in and out of that scene 6 or 7 times, all over the place, looking for us. But she doesn't remember any of that. Nothing. Joanne doesn't remember anything. My daughter only remembers audio cues because she was in a closet and the whole thing was happening like a movie outside playing. And that was real, right? And so everybody experiences it differently. I go back to the human body. Your body will let you have what it needs. And for my wife, it was, you don't need to see dead bodies, because she told me she couldn't see faces. She saw bodies. And I said, because she ended, in the video, she's over one of the kids that ended up dying. He was on his last few breaths. And Jess was over there stroking his chest, telling me he's going to be okay, doing the last motherly thing a child should have before they pass, right? Giving him love from a mother and telling him he's going to be okay, and he passed. But he had that from Jess, and she doesn't remember that until she saw it on the video. And so I think for her, that mother nature, that looking for her family was the biggest thing, because for her, at that point, it had kind of been over. We don't know where this guy is, but I got to find my family. There's no more noise, there's no more gunfire. And so her body told her, go look for me. Those are those things that I think differentiate all of us, but it also makes you a team when you don't expect it. You know what I mean?
So you watched the video.
Yeah.
How did you feel watching it, and did you want to watch the video?
I just wanted to make sure that what I was talking about was actually true. And honestly, like, everybody's like, you tackled the guy. I go, no, Thomas fought him. I didn't know that. And so we all kind of went to the ground together. You know, that initial contact was with Thomas James, and I didn't know it because he was in the front of him and I was in the back. This guy's this huge guy, so you can't see anything around the guy. And so those are those things that I was like, oh, wow, I didn't know that. And then for 6 minutes, I didn't know it was 6 minutes long. I didn't know it was fighting them. I didn't know I tried to shoot him. I knew I took his weapon, but I didn't know I tried to shoot him. I didn't know he tried to shoot me. It was dark. I just knew there was a weapon. I grabbed it from him. That was it, you know? And then the amount of blood and all that stuff, I didn't expect it. I knew I was with Joanne helping her, but seeing the actual scene is just, it's a lot. That said, I digested it as an in-person, you know, this event happened to me. When people watch these videos, there is no human, it goes straight into your brain. And this is why I think a lot of people get really jacked up. And I'll be honest, for all of us, it was harder watching it than it was being in it, because everything goes straight to your brain. There's no human, you know, like I said, my brain told me, hey, you don't need to worry about your wife and kid right now. They're safe. Go to do this and forget about it. But when I go back to it, I'm in the police car screaming and yelling for him, because that's the only thing I wanted at that point, right? So your body will adjust to what's in front of it to make sure that you're doing the things that you need to do to preserve life, whether it's yours or someone else's. When you're watching a video, there's nothing you can do. Your body only digested through its eyes straight to your brain. That's it. And I think it sears in there some of the worst parts of it. And it really, it's not something that I think people should be watching, but I also think it is something that people need to know or be able to see to understand what these kids or what these people are going through. I met the father of one of the kids in Uvalde. And I looked at him, I said, man, I don't know how you do this. This, you lost your 6-year-old, you know, like, is it, or 9-year-old, you lost your little girl. I was freaking out that I might've lost Cassie there, and she was 22. And he goes, Rich, all I wanted to do was bust in there and do what you did. That's so we had this commonality, but it was a totally different scenario. But he lost his child. You know, I look at Raymond's mom the same way. She lost her child, but he was also part of our family. So we all lost our family. We always say, we always refer to the 6 of us by habit, and it's now 5 because we still go out every weekend, either to our house or Joanne, Chicken Joanne's house, hang out with their kids. It's a family. We've done holidays. We've traveled together. So we have stayed close. And I think that helps us get through this stuff. It changes you and your life forever. I tell my buddies, I go to bed every night with a battle buddy. You know, I sleep in the same bed as someone who went through the combat that I went through. And that's hard when we're both having different nightmares or both in a different headspace. Or I'm angry today and she's not. Or my daughter is angry today and I'm not. But we're all in the same room trying to get through it. So we have that support, and we also have the detriment that is having to be around each other who have all gone through the same trauma. And so it's a very challenging thing. I think it's a forever thing. I always tell people to remember these kids that went through it. They're never going to be the same. It's as if they went through combat. I mean, there was more rounds put through that room than I've dealt with in, you know, in that short amount of time, because the enemy doesn't shoot me, doesn't spray me with shit. They're trying to kill me. So they take a control first or whatever. So it's it gets going, but they're trying to kill you. This guy was trying to mow down the world, you know, and that's not something that you can ever get over when you hear a pop now. My daughter and my wife, it's hard for them. I'm sadly, it's something that I'm kind of deaf to because I've heard it before. I heard it there. I heard it everywhere. And so it's kind of like, okay, that's a backfire. That's a this. They just hear every pop as holy shit. You know, and it's in any scenario, because this is any scenario. If a kid's in a school, where else does he think this could happen? If you're at a bowling alley in Maine, you know, it could probably happen in church. Well, it has. You know, like, you pick it. These things happen everywhere, and these people are forever changed. And I think us as viewers of, as consumers of this this type of violence, it's hard to remember that these are survivors, not victims. Is as you said earlier, you know, I've talked to a lot of victims and all this stuff. They're survivors. They survived somehow, whether it's the kid that pretended to be dead, right, and survived. That takes courage. That's a hero movement. Like, to me, it's all about the action you take to preserve life, yours or someone else's. And I think that's some of those things that needs to resonate. A hero isn't somebody who saves the world. It's somebody who saves the person next to me. You know what I mean? And that's what it's all about. So that's kind of the values I've taken from the Army, the kind of the values, just being in combat with buddies that learn it, and then losing buddies that just can't handle it. You know, you learn really quickly that this is not something everybody should be going through. And sadly, it's starting to become more common. We've run into more folks now than we ever have that gone through this kind of thing.
I wanted to ask you, maybe a little bit about the shooter himself. Have you thought much about him, why he was there, why he did what he did, or do you just...
No, there's a special place for that person. And you know, I don't need to forgive or think about or any of that. I don't give him any credit. I think at the end of the day, there's some crazies out there that'll cheer this guy for what he did, for who he did this to. I think it's wholly unfair that he's targeting, this LGBTQ community that only opens their arms to everybody. They're in no way dismissive to any group or person. And this guy decided that was who he wants to go after. No thought process. He's probably had a horrible life, I would assume. And you know, at the end of the day, I don't think about him. I think he needs, he will be forever. He's got like 3,000 years or something like that. He's in a ridiculous amount of time to do. But for us, it's not about thinking about him. It's not about giving him anything. It's more about us. As survivors, our group, and making sure that these kids that really had minimum wage jobs, they were doing the dancing and the drag for free, all of a sudden they're completely changed and no income, and they're working hard. And I always tell people to always think about those kids, and that goes for all these mass shootings. You know, like, you've got to reach out and try and help them, because their life's forever changed.
What has life been like for you after this? You obviously got a lot of media attention. I'm obviously a member of the media. Yeah. I'm talking to you right now about this.
But Ryan, I mean, for me, it was important to talk to folks, and I talked to everyone. I don't care. As long as somebody can see someone like me, a kid that looks like me from San Diego, from, you know, that lives in Colorado, that you know, is an idiot. I do dumb things all the time. And I want them to know that that could be in you. That's something that's not, you know, that's not something you can, you know, that's for that guy. It could be you. And you could be in that situation where you might have to take charge and do what you need to do. I wanted them to see that. I wanted to see a Latino man with all this machismo and combat veteran in an LGBTQ plus club with his daughter and her boyfriend and my family. Wyatt's boyfriend was killed too. So Cassie and Wyatt both lost their significant others in that shooting. And so, you know, the trauma is there. I just want people to see and hear, because watching the video will change you forever, I think. And as we talked about that, I think folks should have access, I guess, but it sears your brain and you'll never get over it when you see it. And I think it instills too much of a panic or fear that later on down the road, this will happen to me. Listen, it's still one of those rare occasions. It feels common because it's the first thing on the news. But it's still a rare thing to be involved in one of these things. So hopefully we can keep it that way. But at the end of the day, I'm a soldier. You know, I've dealt with weapons. I didn't take any political stance on any of this. And I've had people ask, and I'm like, I have my own opinion, but my opinion doesn't matter. What matters is everybody's opinion at a voting box, you know? And so if you want to change things, go change things. I'm trying to keep my family together. And it's hard because all of us are in different modes and different places. And, you know, it's a challenge for the three of us to make every day a good day. And so, yeah, you know, I'm doing mental health. I do every kind of therapy you can think of. I've reached out and done it because I think taking a chance and seeing if it works, you know, do it. I'm on medications, and you know, the VA took really good care of me. They reached out to me and said, hey, do you need anything? I said, yeah, I need to see a doc again. And so they put me right back in. I've been seeing a doc for the last 3 years. Does it help? I don't know, but it makes me feel better for that day. And that's what matters. Yeah.
One of the training sessions I went through with the FBI is kind of their alert system. And when you're caught up in a situation like this, you know, the steps you go through, the run, hide, fight, you obviously took the fight aspect of it. It all depends on kind of where you're at. I suppose we saw in Columbine, there was exit doors that maybe some of those students could have run out of, you know, and they weren't thinking about that at that moment. So, you know, run, hiding, you know, you think, oh, well, I need to hide, or I need to, you know, and it's, every situation is different. Every scenario is different. Every person is different. A person with a military background might be different than, you know, a teacher who's trying to protect 10 of her students in a classroom.
But I would also say, and I think people take for granted that all veterans are going to respond the same way. I think again, it just takes a person that has that ability to function under that kind of stress. That's all. And it could be a teacher. It could be it could be just some random kid in the room. Thomas James is a Navy sailor, and he did the same thing that I did, you know, and he's active duty. I'm not, you know, like he's doing what he thought was right. That goes back to the people covering other people to make sure they don't get shot. Those are those things I think that translate the same way. The run part, you hear, again, I go back to the brain. Your brain might have known that was an exit, but it remembers the last exit you went to. So you're going to keep running. You know what I mean? Like, so it's one of those things that you can't really put a thumb on it and say, this is the right thing to do. I still go through these trainings because I work for the DOD. So I go through these, you know, active shooter training. And I'm like, listen, dude, don't take for granted that everybody in this room, because we're veterans, is going to do the right thing. A lot of them won't. And a lot of, because they're just human, you know, and some people haven't ever been through this. And so I take for granted that people will do one of those things, run, hide, fight. And that's it, you know, like, and you got to figure it out at that point. It's chaos. You know, it's, some people are trained to manage chaos. Some people are not. And some people were trained for it, never did it. And when they get in the situation, can't do it. I'm not saying I'm better than anyone. I think it's a sad thing, because I tend to go to fight, even in situations where I shouldn't, you know, and that's part of what I'm trying to fix. And I want to, you know, I'll see somebody do something weird and I'm already in there trying to fight them. And my wife's like, listen, that's their thing. That's not, you know, you don't have to go into everybody's business. And so I have to learn that too, you know? And so I think at the end of the day, everybody will figure it out on their own. But one of those things has to happen in your body. So the more you learn about it, I think it makes it easier for you to respond in the way you need to.
When you watch a similar situation play out, because there obviously have been more since Club Q, what is it that we in the media, when we represent these events, is there anything that we're doing wrong? Is there anything you're like, oh, I wish they wouldn't say that. I wish they wouldn't talk about this like that.
No, I mean, I think everybody does it differently, you know, and that's kind of why the media is what it is. I was an artillery officer. I did a lot of information ops and public affairs stuff. And so I understand the value of making sure people are informed. And I think that's what matters, to get the facts out there. But I think following up has been what nobody does anymore. You know, like Barbara Walters would interview. I just watched her show. So she would do the interview and then she'd follow up four or five years later and revisit some of that stuff. And you'd be like, man, they've evolved. They've done this. They've done that, you know. And I think people tend to think with these survivors, like, it's one and done. I got the interview, I'm out. And maybe reengaging 5 years down the road or 10 years down the road and saying, how is everybody doing at Uvalde? How's everybody doing at Columbine? I was at Congressman Crow's. He had me over for the State of the Union, and he's not even my district, but his district contains Columbine. And one of his workers in there is a Columbine victim. And she was there in the high school. And so when you look at those things, they're moving on. You know, they're trying to get through their life. But sometimes looking back and reflecting and maybe digging into a different part of the story is something to look at down the road. I just think the follow-up never happens anymore. And so it's a fire and forget. And that's how you lose. You know, people think this stuff, you know, goes away. It doesn't. And hopefully, you know, that'll teach folks that this is not something you do and hope that you can become famous out of. I think there was one shooting that stuck out of my mind. It was in Colorado, and this kid went into the school, and he had a shotgun, and he shot the first kid, and then he killed himself. His body told him, this is not what you're supposed to do, you know? Like, it is ugly. And what people don't understand is the human body, when you see it do things it's not supposed to, and it's just like a car wreck, and you see an arm over there, or, you know, somebody twisted up, there's a reason that those football accidents where, you know, heel thighs, and when you pick it, people are, like, enthralled, and because it's a human, and you see things happen that aren't supposed to, it changes you forever.
Maybe this isn't the right word for it, but is there like a fraternity or people who have been in similar situations? You've obviously connected with Uvalde. You mentioned Columbine. I mean, I'm sure Sandy Hook, some Parkland. I mean, are you interacting with these people? Is there everyone just kind of goes off in their own kind? You know, that you're not the same people. You had different experiences, albeit under one umbrella, I suppose.
Yeah. And Ryan, I mean, I was in a room full of strangers. I knew nobody in that club but the six of us. So it's like people would ask me, how's so-and-so doing? I go, I have no idea. I'd never met him. I met him at the club and I met him at court. But there's a bond. We obviously all give each other hugs and we give each other love and we support each other, but they do their own lives, you know? And so that's the other kind of weird part about this, is you're bonded by tragedy, and that's not something everybody wants to be bonded by. I had a funny story. There was two gentlemen that were at the time dating. They're married now, but they were sitting on the wall opposite of us, and we were in the club, and that night everything was going well. And they had this fan that kept making a pop noise, and I noticed it now at Pride that this is like a very popular thing. It's a fan that clacks. And I was telling my wife, that's a cool noisemaker, man. I'd love to have something like that for the football games or whatever. It's just clack, 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 clack. And they were doing that the whole night. They had come to the brewery, and they stopped in to say hello, and they wanted to, you know, talk and kind of talk about the incident because they were there. So they came in, and I said, yeah, we were there. And I said, where were you sitting? And they're like, we're against the wall. I go, did you have that fan? He goes, yeah, that was me. And I go, oh my God, that's kind of crazy. We were talking about you. He went back, he left the brewery, goes into his car, pulls the fan out, brings it in. And so now in the brewery sits the fan that was at that shooting, but that kid wanted to give me, because it connected us without us ever talking, right? Yeah. I heard this thing, I was talking about him. And then when he comes in with his husband, he got shot through the neck. Like, I don't know how the hell he survived, but he got shot through his neck. His husband got shot in two or three, you know, holes. But again, we're connected in this strange way, because we look at other people around us and we want to, you know, kind of participate. I always told people that maybe at Walmart, when this guy was buying the crap he needed to do this, if somebody would have saw this kid, the shooter, and said, hey man, how you doing today? What's up? That's it. You know, maybe it would have changed his life or thought process about humanity or whatever. We don't do that anymore. But I freak people out because I always walk into a room like, hey, how you doing? My name is Rich. How you doing? How you doing? And people are like, whoa, you know, like most people are on their phone and waiting for the meeting to start or waiting for the event to start. And nobody wants to talk. And I think that's that connection that hopefully can change some things because we are all way too, you know, isolated in our own little bubbles.
Are you able to, you've been able to get out from under that tragic event? I mean, you've got the brewery going on. Well, like what's life look like for you now? When you're smiling, that's good, right?
Yeah. Well, I tend to do that. I talk about these things because I think it's important, but for us as a family, we've worked at the business. I told people like we survived. So we opened in 2018. We survived the pandemic, which, you know, I don't know how many businesses didn't make it, especially breweries. And then now there's this kind of recession thing with all these breweries closing around us. But we also had a mass shooting happen in between where three of our six employees were in the shooting. And so you're like, what do I do with this? You know, like our team became our family. They took care of us for 6-7 months after this. They ran that business on their own. And so for us, they're still there. Great, great, great people. And we treat them like that. And I think it's a small business thing too. You always treat them like family because you're around each other more than you are with your family. My wife's been working really hard trying to get this business to grow. And we just started at the airport here in Colorado Springs. She's gotten our beer set up. So we are now, when you come off the airplane and you exit the terminal, we're the first thing you see when you walk out is after the beer company. So there's some good things going on. It's a struggle, but at the end of the day, you know, you have to move forward. It's the same thing when losing family members, you know, it's a tragedy. You think about them every day, but you also move on to the next thing because that's what they'd want you to do.
What's the brewery? Where can people go and what do you got on tap right now?
they got 16 taps, so I don't even want to guess. But my favorite is the Hibiscus Anyone You Want. So the girls do, so it's all women that brew. And they do like they only brew things that they want, they have like a connection with or a story. And so Hibiscus Anyone You Want is Taylor's beer. It was sort of pride beer. And it's a hibiscus, I want to say it's kind of like a Belgian blondie thing with a hibiscus flavor. It's amazing beer. We love it. And it has a story, you know. My wife did a beer called Illegal, which a lot of people laugh at, but it's the letter E. A dash legal, like a lawyer. And my brother was in law school. He would sign his emails. He was still, you know, with that little, we're both little punks and, you know, trying to be cool. And so he'd sign his emails E-legal because he was going to be a lawyer. And so we made his beer Illegal. And it's his favorite kind of beer, Imperial Rye IPA. And we had a Juneteenth beer back in 18 when nobody knew what Juneteenth was. And we're looking to celebrate culture with the brewer. And so we don't want to throw it in your face. We want you to go, hey, what's that mean? And we'll tell you. And we'll go from there. Start a conversation where I think if folks knew more about each other, hopefully they'd be better to each other. And that's kind of what our goal is.
At the point of this recording, the surveillance video from the night had not yet been released. There are numerous other heroes we reached out to. Some have openly shared their stories to the public. Some have previously shared their stories, but now choose not to. Others still aren't ready or have decided not to tell their stories.